Next case is 10-1842, State of Ohio versus Carl M. Morris, Jr. Mr. Kern.
Good morning, Your Honor. Madam Chief Justice, Justices, opposing counsel, may it please the court. My name is Matthew Kern. On behalf of Dean Holman, the Medina County Prosecutor, I represent the state of Ohio in this matter. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes, if I may. This case is about the standard of review to be applied in cases where a trial court admits evidence pursuant to Evidence Rule 404B. The appellate court in this instance said, we will no longer apply the abuse of discretion standard. We will instead apply a de novo standard. That runs afoul of numerous decisions of this court as recently as 2009, back to 2008, 2006, 2004, and some of which are capital cases. The appellate court's reasoning for doing so, justification, is that this evidence is so potentially dangerous that it deserves a heightened standard of review. But this court has long held that the admission of evidence, not particular evidence, not just in questions of relevancy, not just in any other instance, but the admission of evidence is bound by the abuse of discretion standard. And other decisions of this court have held that an abuse of discretion is more than a mere error in law or judgment. Abuse of discretion is a decision that is unreasonable, arbitrary, or unconscionable, or one that evokes no sound reasoning process behind that determination. In this case, the trial court heard the evidence, heard the objection, decided that it met any of the non-exhaustive enumerated purposes behind 404B, and decided it would admit the evidence. The appellate court, in conducting its de novo review, said that were we the trial court, we would not admit this evidence. Therefore, this evidence was improperly admitted, and because they found that it wasn't harmless, but I think they were conducting a form of the material prejudice standard, said we would not admit it. It was improperly admitted. It prejudiced the defendant, caused the jury to convict. Therefore, his conviction is reversed. Assuming that this court continues to abide by what it has said, the admission of evidence is bound by an abuse of discretion standard and not any other standard, that decision is for
allowed. Counsel, does the prejudicial nature of the evidence govern any part of an abuse of discretion analysis?
I don't believe so. I think that is, well, are you asking if 404, if 403 comes into the analysis of whether 404B evidence is properly admitted?
Well, in this particular case, as it's applied, I mean, I understand what you're saying about the de novo review is not appropriate, that it's an abuse of discretion on matters of evidence. But what happens when the determination is that this evidence is prejudicial? It is, and it is reviewed under an abuse of discretion. My question is, does the prejudicial nature of the evidence come into play in an abuse of discretion analysis?
I mean, I'm not saying that it can't, but, well, two things. One, I think we should distinguish between prejudicial evidence and unfairly prejudicial evidence. This court has said, you know, any evidence of guilt is prejudicial to the defendant. But in terms of this evidence being, you know, evidence potentially that this defendant has done other things that are wrong, certainly, well, and that evidence.
Let's just deal in the world of unfairly prejudicial.
Sure.
Okay, you're saying under an abuse of discretion, unfairly prejudicial evidence is not taken into consideration, or is it?
No, I think that analysis is always done in the admission of any evidence is either general relevancy determinations or, you know, anything along those lines. 403 applies to any evidence to be admitted in any case, including 404B. And the trial court in this case, you know, implicitly does that analysis in admitting all of the evidence that, you know, the child victim who testifies in the case that the defendant raped me. The evidence about the child victim's mother, the defendant's wife, testifying to specific instances about, you know, yes, I was in the hospital on such and such a date, when the child victim testifies that one of the instances of the rape happens when the child victim's mother is in the hospital. That evidence is all damaging, and, you know, some of it is, well, do we need to know about
I mean, obviously, when you're recounting dates and times and activities that are relevant to the activities that are at issue at trial, there's a whole different way of looking at that as opposed to some of the other evidence that we're talking about in this case.
I'm not sure I see that distinction, though. The trial court is making that implicit, that is, the trial court inherently is making that determination about the unfair prejudice of any evidence in a case. It's determining whether or not this evidence is inflammatory or whether or not the jury may be potentially misled by it, any of the traditional 403 factors in determining whether or not this evidence should be admitted despite its clear probative value. The trial court made that determination in this case. One of the instances, the defense counsel at trial made an objection. Your Honor, you know, this evidence is unfairly prejudicial to my client, and the trial court identifies it. Oh, you're making a 403 analysis. Yes. Okay. The trial court did that, made that determination in this case. The trial court heard defense counsel's argument on 403, said, no, I find that the danger of unfair prejudice is not substantially outweighed by its probative value. Therefore, back to 404B, it meets some of the enumerated non-exhaustive purposes. I'm admitting it. It was not an abuse of discretion for the trial court to make that determination. The problem in this case is that the appellate court applied a de novo standard.
No other court has applied a de novo standard to this kind of review, to your knowledge?
The Ninth District's majority opinion in this case cites to a 1983, I believe, Second District case, which the Second District doesn't even follow anymore. Every other district in the state applies an abuse of discretion standard. And so, this court itself.
So the legal issue for us is, on a 404B other act evidence review, mm-hmm. what is the appropriate standard? And you're arguing to us that it should be an abuse of discretion, as it is all over Ohio, except in this case.
Correct.
So is that a matter of error correction for us, or is it a matter of a rule that needs to be promulgated? And I guess the follow-up question is, has that rule been promulgated somewhere in our jurisprudence in other cases?
I understand the concern that this looks like error correction. The problem is that two things. This court has never specifically addressed whether or not evidentiary determinations are legal conclusions, or as evidentiary conclusions, whether or not they are not legal conclusions and just matters of evidence. This court has never addressed that narrow issue. But the other thing I would say is the appellate court has changed the law in the state by applying a new standard despite the clear holdings of this court to the contrary. I would suggest that if this court is not prepared to tell the appellate courts that when they try to change the standards of review that they should not do so, you know, error correction would actually stand in the way of a consistent standard of review in the state. Producing inconsistent results.
Mr. Kern, the question here is, how much deference should we give to the trial court, or should the Court of Appeals give to the trial court? When you're talking about normal evidence rulings, whether evidence is in or out, the abuse of discretion does come into play. Does it go to the jury? Does it not go to the jury? But we're talking here about a mixed question, are we not? Otherwise, you would have the Court of Appeals never looking at a 404B determination unless it was truly prejudicial from, I mean, beyond the pale. In other words, totally an abuse of discretion. It seems to me the Court of Appeals looked at this with a new eye, even though the evidence was in, but also reviewed it to see if it truly was unfairly prejudicial, as the Chief Justice was just mentioning.
Sure. I think that to answer the first part of your question, the determination by the appellate court about whether or not a trial court abuses its discretion is an inherently fact-laden, case-by-case analysis determination. The asking about specific evidence presented in a case in context with the rest of the evidence presented at trial involves a nuanced reading. It's not something that can be done just, you know, black letter, here is the rule, apply it and move on. I think this, you know, this court recognizes in the other cases talking about whether an abuse of discretion analysis is appropriate for evidence that all of the evidence determinations involve specific case-by-case factually intensive analysis. And that's why we defer to trial courts who are in the best position to hear the evidence, see the evidence, observe the witnesses at trial, and make that determination not from a cold record, but as they're sitting there looking at it. As for the other part about the abuse of discretion standard, yes, the appellate court is looking at this in terms of there's a danger of unfair prejudice, but the rules of evidence are a systematic scheme designed to place trial courts as our gatekeepers in terms of admitting or not admitting evidence. If the appellate court's application of a de novo standard of review in this case is to go, is to continue, you would be removing the keys from the trial court. If trial courts are the gatekeepers, they have to be trusted with the keys. And the de novo standard review says, we don't trust you anymore. I would see that the other interesting issue in this case is after the state moved for en banc hearing of the case, the appellate court in its 3-2 decision refusing to hear the case en banc conducted an alternative analysis of the abuse of discretion standard, saying even if we were to apply the abuse of discretion standard in this case, we would still reverse. It would be the state's position that that analysis proceeds from a faulty premise. It's still the appellate court in conducting abuse of discretion analysis says we would not admit this evidence. Therefore, when the trial court decided to admit the evidence, it abused its discretion. Abuse of discretion analysis has to proceed from a deferential.
But isn't the reason that they didn't what was the reason that they would not have admitted this evidence?
They found that it was unfairly prejudicial. It was character evidence that wasn't – it didn't go to help establish any of the non-exhaustive enumerated purposes of 404B.
If a trial court allows unfairly prejudicial evidence in, is that not an abuse of discretion?
Under the way I read the abuse of discretion standard, I know it's – it doesn't sit right at first glance, but the way I read the abuse of discretion standard, a trial court does not abuse its discretion by mere errors of law or judgment, even if it comes to an incorrect determination about whether or not to admit
evidence.
So
what's the remedy under those circumstances if it's an unfairly prejudicial piece of evidence that is in?
Well, I think the evidence was admitted. It wasn't an abuse of discretion for the trial court to do so.
So you have to have it declared such that it taints the whole proceedings in order to allow for it to be reversible.
Right. It would have to be a material prejudice to the defendant's right to a fair trial. That would have to it would have to convince the jury of their guilt that such that the trial court would have no confidence in the eventual outcome of the case. Barring that, it's a kind of harmless error.
Counsel, I'm glad you brought it up because I was going to point out page 45 of the Court of Appeals opinion. They say even applying an abuse of discretion standard of review, this case would be reversed because the trial court does not have discretion to admit evidence that is prohibited by Rule 404B. Regardless of what this court calls it, Mr. Morris was prejudiced by the admission of highly inflammatory testimony that tended to prove Mr. Morris was the type of man who might act in a sexually inappropriate manner with his stepdaughter. So I come to Justice O'Donnell's question, isn't what's new here? I mean, if that's what they're saying, what's our reason for even deciding this case? Because you seem to say there is no such thing as abuse of discretion.
No, I certainly believe that a trial court theoretically could abuse its discretion.
How?
It could make an arbitrary determination without hearing any arguments, just deciding the issue without the benefit of...
That's abuse of discretion? That's the only kind of abuse of discretion?
Or an unreasonable application of the law? An unconscionable decision? Certainly. There are ways that a trial court could abuse its discretion.
Okay.
Thank you.
Mr. Sheldon.
Chief Justice O'Connor, may it please the court. The issue that this court's going to have to decide is whether or not it must reverse remand this case to the Ninth District Court of Appeals and instruct it to apply an abuse of discretion standard, or whether or not it can affirm this court, the Ninth District Court of Appeals decision, based on the decision it rendered.
Well, didn't they already decide the issue on an abuse of discretion in reality?
They did, Your Honor. I agree that with the court's analysis, that is, in the en banc opinion, it determined, as Justice Pfeiffer pointed out, that even if we were to apply the abuse of discretion standard, we would rule that the court abused its discretion by allowing materially prejudicial evidence before the
jury. But in the bigger picture, they admit by revisiting it and saying even if we applied the abuse of discretion, they're admitting that they used a de novo standard of review. And that's of greater concern to us, you know, as this court, as opposed to just the circumstances of Mr. Morse. And that's what we need to take a look at. Is the application, or excuse me, the de novo review appropriate when reviewing pieces of evidence that were admitted on the trial level? And when is de novo required, and when is abuse of discretion required?
Thank you, Chief Justice. I think this goes back to Justice Lanziger's question, whether or not this is a mixed question here when you analyze 404B evidence. And the Ninth District Court of Appeals basically said it is a mixed question of review. In the first instance, regarding 404B evidence, the trial court or the appellate court must make a determination whether or not the evidence itself fit within any of the enumerated exceptions. And the court stated if it does not, then the court does not have discretion to go ahead and admit that evidence if it doesn't fit within any of those stated exceptions. And in this case, the appellate court, even though it stated and followed and referred to this court's precedents in State versus DR and State versus Conway and the numerous ones cited by the state, that it's an abuse of discretion standard that's applied regarding the admission of other acts evidence. In practice, what the appellate courts are doing in each case is they're determining whether or not the evidence itself fit within any of those enumerated exceptions. And that is a question of law that is made in the first determination.
But it seems to me that they almost bootstrap the question of law. I mean, they say, okay, you shouldn't have admitted this, so now it's a question of law, when in really it's abuse of discretion, it's a factual issue, just like the dissent pointed out. There are two different views of this evidence and whether it should be admitted. That should be an abuse of discretion, but they've twisted it and called it, well, it's really an issue of law. They should never have admitted this. How do you separate out those two issues?
Your Honor, I agree it's difficult to separate those issues, but I think the court could say in the first instance when reviewing these cases, it is with respect to 404B evidence, and I think 404B evidence is really a separate animal. This court has ruled on numerous 404B cases, and the admissibility, as the court knows, is strict against the state in all those cases where the court's reviewing to admit that evidence, that is the trial court. And it's powerful evidence, and there's been many convictions because of that evidence. But I think getting back to your question, I think under abuse of discretion standard, and I think the question was posed by Justice O'Connor, well, how is material prejudice intertwined with that. Well, abuse of discretion must create material prejudice. And in this case, as the Court of Appeals stated in its en banc opinion, it did create material prejudice if we were to apply that abuse of discretion standard.
It isn't a clear analysis that separates the issues of fact and law to say, is this a 404B? Is this that type of evidence? And if you determine that it's that type of evidence, then you look at whether the court abuses discretion in admitting it under that standard. Isn't that a much clearer issue than to say, oh, we get to review their admission of this evidence because it's a 404B?
Yes, Your Honor. I think that would be an appropriate standard to be applied in these cases. In the first instance, we must determine whether or not it fit within one of the enumerated exceptions, which is a question of law. And if so, the second analysis is, if the trial court or the appellate court says yes, the trial court made the appropriate determination fit within one of the exceptions, you must still go to 403, which says, and 403A is mandatory, if the trial court determines that the probative value is substantially outweighed by the prejudicial effect, then exclusion is mandatory under 403. But you still get the discretion.
Did this court kind of get it backwards and then try to correct it in the en banc by saying, well, we really, even if we do an abuse, they still should not have admitted the evidence?
I think to agree, you're correct. I think that's correct to a degree, Your Honor. But I think in the analysis, I don't think the court's analysis was faulty in terms of how it came to its conclusion. I think the court properly interpreted or applied the de novo to the first question under 404B in terms of whether or not it fits in within one of those enumerated exceptions. I think that analysis was correct because it takes place in every case, whether it's appellate counsel reviewing a transcript. I'm not looking whether it's abuse of discretion or it's a de novo review on appeal. I'm looking to see, was this correct in terms of the court's ruling in admitting this evidence? And of course, we all look to the case law to see what the case law, how that guides us on that issue. But with respect to 404B, in this particular case, under either standard of review, as the Court of Appeals stated, we would reach the same result.
Under 404B, your objection is to the sister's testimony, which I believe the state contends was trying to show a pattern of behavior from the defendant. That's what you say is so prejudicial it should not come into the record.
Justice McGee-Brown, that instance and the other instance when the trial court, over objection, allowed an open-ended question to be asked by the prosecutor, what would happen during these disagreements where, you know, you refuse to have sex with them, objection made, answers allowed to an open-end question, gives that witness free rein to say whatever happened, and she did, verbally abusive, mentally abusive, and even kicked and hit the dog. And
if we let's push that evidence aside, is your objection to the sister's testimony about how the defendant approached her to demonstrate a pattern?
Yes, Your Honor. Mr. Morris vehemently objects to that evidence for the reasons stated by the Ninth District Court of Appeals. One has nothing to do with the other. Was not even a sexual offense. He grabbed her around the waist, pulled her towards him while he was apparently intoxicated because she smelled alcohol in his breath, and made a comment that she perceived to be sexual. That event has absolutely nothing to do with sexual conduct with a 9-year-old half-sister in this case. There's no inextricably or intertwined relationship, as this court has stated in State versus Wilkinson, State versus Broome, between those acts. None. There's no similarity. There's no common scheme, plan, or system by him grabbing a half-sister that's older and is adult and allegedly raping, committing these acts of rape against the half-sister that's 9 years old. There's no similarity whatsoever.
By your same description, it's hard to find that grabbing the adult sister while he's drunk has any prejudicial effect by letting it be admitted. How is that even prejudicial then?
Well, because it put in front of the jury could infer from that incident that it was sexual in nature, and because he made an advance towards the half-sister that was sexual in nature, then it's more probable than not that he violated his half-sister by engaging in sexual conduct with the half-sister.
So does it go to motive or purpose then? Is that what you're saying? That's what the statute allows.
Justice O'Donnell, I don't believe it goes towards motive or purpose. I don't think in this case that the act of grabbing a half-sister adult around the waist shows any motive to commit, as the Court of Appeals stated, shows any motive to commit an act against a 9-year-old stepdaughter or half-sister. I don't think there is motive there. Just because he did that doesn't mean he had a motive to commit the acts against his half-sister.
Do we have the power to decide whether the trial or the Court of Appeals abused its discretion in finding that the trial court abused its discretion? Let's say we disagree with, let's say we agree with the dissent. We don't agree with the majority. Do we have the ability to reverse the Court of Appeals on an abuse of discretion in their finding that the trial court abused its discretion? It's kind of a double whammy.
Well, Your Honor, I don't think so. And the reason is I raised six assignments of error in the Court of Appeals. The appellate court only decided one assignment of error. And for the benefit and justice of Carl Morris, Jr., I think there's very pertinent assignments of error in those other five assignments of error.
If we reverse this, it needs to go back to the Court of Appeals for the other assignments of error. But do we have that right, that power here, to find the trial court or the Court of Appeals abuse its discretion?
I don't think under these circumstances that would be appropriate.
No, that's not my question. My question is, do we have the right? Not whether this we should hear.
I believe the court does have that right. I believe it can exercise its judicial review and determine whether or not.
Well, counsel, I was thinking along the same lines as Justice Stratton. We're a little hemmed in, are we not, by the fact that we have it here on a single proposition of law. But for that, we might be looking at this and saying, well, yes, it was prejudicial, and no, it should not have been admitted, but in the general scheme of things, there was so much other evidence against your client that it doesn't matter. We do that upon occasion, but it seems to me that we're not even because we have it here on the limited proposition law, we're not in that arena. But if we were thinking along those lines, I assume the issue is this comes down to a he said, she said. There's no physical evidence because it's so far removed from the time that the conviction rises and falls on her testimony. The victim's testimony without these other things that the prosecution brought in. So it takes on a greater importance than it would in a case where there was other physical evidence.
Yes, Your Honor.
But can we get there even?
If the court determines that this case must be reversed and remanded to the Ninth District, I think then it would be appropriate at that time for the Ninth District to apply the abuse of discretion standard and review all assignments of error under that standard because, as I mentioned, it only reviewed one assignment of error, and that was the 404B evidence. And I don't think it – I think the court obviously has that right to do that, but I think under this these circumstances, I think it would be appropriate given the fact that there was a dearth of evidence in this case to support – or corroborate what SK said in terms of what happened, that it would be appropriate for the Ninth District to consider all assignments of error under that standard since only one was considered, and that was the 404B standard.
So if we reverse, this goes back to the Ninth District?
Yes, Your Honor.
And if we affirm,
go back to the trial court where it was before you exercised your
jurisdiction. We go back to the trial court for a new trial?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. Getting back to the original question here, the 404B, and it always being a question, you know, a mixed question for determination, I'm not sure that I disagree that the Ninth District did not approach this correctly. They just maybe didn't go far enough in their first analysis. The evidence that is in question, whether it falls into one of the enumerated exceptions, and if so, initially they didn't go to the abuse of discretion to determine whether this is materially so materially prejudiced that it admitting it is an abuse of discretion. And they did eventually, I mean, they did get there and say, even if we just used abuse of discretion, we still would come to the same place. So if you read the entire Ninth District's opinion on this matter, I'm not sure that they didn't do what was required of them, and maybe is what is required in all of these 404B questions.
I agree with you, Justice O'Connor. I think it does require that analysis. I think the court must, and while the state says you take away the keys on abuse of discretion, I disagree because the analysis remains the same. The court and the appellate court in the first instance must determine whether or not...
That's never really been spelled out, and I guess that's something that the appellant is noting here, that this process, and if there is one benefit that could come of, you know, writing on this opinion, it would be to spell out the first and second steps under a 404B analysis. Clarify it.
Yes, Your Honor. And I would ask the court, respectfully request or ask the court to consider doing so in this particular case, and I think it would be helpful and instructive to all appellate courts and trial courts throughout the state of Ohio. And doing so does not take away the court's discretion and put the trial court in the precarious position of having to worry about his decisions all the time. The trial court judges make those decisions every day in every courtroom in the state of Ohio making those decisions. They're not thinking about the appeal. They're making those decisions, and they know that in many cases their decisions are going to be reviewed by an appellate court and perhaps this court. So I don't think it changes how trial judges act in the courtroom in terms of this court making such a ruling.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Kern? You have used up all of your time. You can have 30 seconds.
Thank you, Your Honor. I just want to make a little bit of a factual correction to start. Mr. Sheldon suggested there was a dearth of evidence aside from the child victim's testimony. That's not necessarily the case. The child victim testified to specific conduct when she was raped by the defendant, and the mother testified in corroboration with that testimony that, yes, when he had sex with me, he did many of those same things. So her testimony is not uncorroborated or not any other evidence to support her testimony. It is there is other evidence in this case. But I would, getting back to the larger issue, the question of whether or not evidence fits within an exception under 404B is a factually intensive one. It's not a question of law, I don't believe. You have to determine, does this particular evidence address this particular non-exhaustive enumerated purpose under 404B, make a question. Fundamentally, it's a question of relevancy. Does this evidence tend to establish one of those purposes? Knowledge, absence of mistake, motive, opportunity. In this case, the trial court made that determination. The appellate court applied a de novo standard of review.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We will take the matter under advisement. You'll be notified of our opinion.